supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, fighting a cold. Later on in the show, we'll talk about the cold, as in, can an inexpensive greenhouse keep the cold away from your plants? We'll also talk a little bit about cold frames, but mostly it is a phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're jumping right to your fabulous ones at 1-888-346-9499. AJ, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how are you today?
I am fighting off a cold, a flu, a virus, a bacteria. They're beating me up, AJ. They've grown to gigantic size and not only are making me sick, but tormenting and taunting me and giving me wedgies. How are you, sir?
I'm a little sick myself. I took your advice and shredded up my leaves this weekend and got a little dust in the system. I'm feeling a little under the weather myself.
Okay, well, that's a strange time of year to shred up your leaves. But yes, that material can get really dusty, especially when it's been dry. So years ago, I bought a box of like 100 of those little temporary dust masks. And every time I go out and shred up my leaves now, I put one of those things on. And I hate wearing it, you know, because it steams up your glasses if it's warm out and everything. But then you see all the brown dust on the outside and you realize, you know, that was a good idea.
Yep, I just got a delivery of those from Amazon today.
All right, good man. You're ahead of me. All right, what can we do for you now then, sir? Oh, wait a minute. Where are you?
I'm in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Excellent. What a beautiful climate that is. All right, what can we do for AJ and NC?
So we moved into our house about 2 years ago, and there's a lot of bushes on the property that I like, but I'm not crazy about their location.
Okay.
I'm wondering, what's the best time to move them? And if I can get away with cutting them back a little to make them easier to move.
Yes to both questions. Now, do you know what we're talking about?
So there's three species that I want to move. There's an azalea, there's a couple of euonymuses, and a couple of acubas.
Okay. The azalea is a spring bloomer, so you're going to enjoy the flowers this coming spring. And then after the flowers begin to fade, you can cut it back by a good third, and then you can transplant it. That is when it's going to be at its strongest. Some other plants are going to be better at being transplanted in the fall, but a spring bloomer like azalea, that's the perfect time. After the flowers fade, you can cut it back pretty hard, and then just be really cautious. Azaleas and rhododendrons both have very fragile root systems. So, and this is the same technique I'm going to suggest you use with all your plants.
Okay.
You get a case of good beer. You get a bunch of your friends over. Make sure they all have high-quality shovels. Shovels with good sharp tips and, you know, really well-welded, you know, hammered-out shovels. Good high-quality metal ones. So then you will dig in a circle around the plant. What you want to do is as far out as the furthest branch went before you pruned it back, that's where you want to dig. So we're talking, this is going to be a big mound of dirt you're going to be moving. So, but you get four guys with shovels or four people with shovels who are in good shape, and you make a complete circle around. Then you try to lift the plant out with its roots in an island of dirt. Really, you're imitating what they do when they put bald and burlap plants, when they move those around. One of the things that always shocks people is finding out just how heavy that root ball is. It's much heavier than the basic plant. So when you get it out of the ground, then you see how big an island of soil you have. You go dig the new hole to kind of match that in the new location, and then don't drag it there. Have a tarp right next to it. Lift the plant on the tarp, and then have somebody at each corner, and then take the tarp over to the new location. Now, tell me about the other two plants. I don't grow those personally. I'm not as familiar with them. What's their bloom schedule like?
Neither really has any blooms of any significance, and in any case, I'm really more concerned with getting these out of the bed so I can kind of start over than I am about getting the blooms.
All right. Well, then the advice is the same. As you get later into the springtime, you want to be more and more careful. If you're doing this during hot weather, you want to make sure the plant gets dug up in the early evening, not first thing in the morning, so that it has time to fall into its new location and get settled in before, you know, maybe a scorching 90-degree North Carolina day. No matter what, when you get the plant to its new location, try to make sure it's planted at the same height or even a little bit higher. And then for each new plant you move, take a hose and turn the faucet so that it's just dripping, and just let that hose lay at the base of the plant and drip like that for a good 12, 24 hours. And do that in sequence for each plant. Unless you're really clever and you do it right before you get a good rain, and then you can stay inside.
All right.
But springtime would be fine for this. Springtime is great for pruning them back. You can reduce each of them by a third. And just remember, the heavier it is and the more work it is, the better the chance the plants are going to survive.
Sounds good. I appreciate the advice.
All right. Thank you, AJ.
Thanks.
Take care.
You too.
1-888-346-9499. Janae, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thank you, Mr. McGrath. It is so incredible to be here with you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Where are you?
I live in the southwest corner of the Ozarks, Missouri Ozarks. It's Zone 6, and it's in between Springfield and Joplin.
Yeah.
Very
okay.
Rural.
Yeah. It's an unusual climate. It's a challenging climate for a gardener.
I lived 30 years in Hawaii, so this is all new to me. I'm not sure what's normal and what's not. But I am good with plants, and I have a question about asparagus, but mostly about the weeds. My plants grow very well, however, so do the weeds. And especially with asparagus, as you know, they have a very shallow rhizome, the roots spread out, and, you know, you pull the weeds and you pull up the asparagus. And my asparagus grows great, but toward July, oh, my gosh, I can't even find it. I mean, it's really hard. No, the weeds are like, and I just was looking on this next summer, and I really wanted some advice. I use those flame torches.
Oh, sure.
You can't do that in an asparagus bed, or you just burn up your asparagus.
You know like what, it. Though, Janae? You could do it now. There are two things you could do now. One is to use a flame weeder. You know, your asparagus crowns are deeper than you think, I suspect. But you can use your flame weeder to go over the surface of the soil, and that would incinerate a lot of weed seeds that are lurking at the surface
right.
or just underneath. There's also a device you can buy that uses steam. And this is an old gardening technique. Back at the turn of the century, there were Amish farmers who somehow retrofitted their tractors to have boilers on them and mm-hmm. with jets that they pointed at the ground. And they would run these steam machines over the growing fields towards the end of winter, and it would boil the weed seeds. And it just, it only affects like the top inch of the surface
right.
of the soil. You know, if you go online, you'll see these machines being sold for like $100, handheld ones. So now let's discuss your asparagus. So in the spring, the asparagus comes up and the weeds aren't too bad. But by the time we get to the end of spring and the beginning of summer, your asparagus should be finishing up, so to speak. The new spears coming up are relatively thin, right?
Yep. But so, I even eat those. I mean, I didn't.
No, Janae, you're causing some of your own problems. You are supposed to stop harvesting when the new spears that emerge are as thin or thinner than a pencil. If you over-harvest, you exhaust the roots and you give the edge to the weeds. So in the future, I want you to harvest correctly. It's just a spring crop. Once the new shoots coming up are really thin, you stop harvesting, but you let those shoots continue to grow and develop into fronds. At the same time, you get all the shredded leaves you can from the previous year or a similar type of material. But the shredded leaves from the previous year would be the perfect material for this. And you would spread mm-hmm. those several inches deep between the giant fronds that have come up. And that will prevent new weed seeds from blowing in. Then I think if you do that, if you stop harvesting at the right time, and then you mulch mm-hmm. that growing bed really well, making sure you leave, you know, enough good plants to regenerate the bed. You want those fronds to grow up and absorb solar energy all summer long. That's how you keep the roots big and healthy, and a big healthy root will outcompete some weeds.
I understand asparagus can handle a lot of nitrogen too. Is that correct?
Yes, it can.
So what if I were to take my straw chicken compost out of the
Oh, perfect. Absolutely
in?
Perfect. If you've got bedding with chicken manure mixed into it, that would be the perfect mulch.
Thank you so much. I am just so honored that you would take my question, and I love your program. And now I love it even more. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll appear at the Brandywine 100 Library in North Wilmington, Delaware on Wednesday evening, February 22nd, and at the Capitol Garden Show in Chantilly, Virginia on Saturday and Sunday, February 25th and 26th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with the straight talk about cheap greenhouses and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 140th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Struggling Mike McGrath, and later on in the show, we will struggle to enlighten you as to exactly what a greenhouse can do for you and what it is incapable of doing. But before that, lots of your capable phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Josh, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being had, Josh. Where are you, man?
I'm calling out Oklahoma City.
What can we do for Josh in Oklahoma City?
Well, I'm having a problem. I'm not an experienced gardener by any stretch of the word, but I've done some house planting with my pothos plant, which I heard was a really easy, you know, kind of carefree starter plant if you're going to do some house planting, and I did it with my daughters. That's kind of a project. And after doing some research, I saw that you could take your clippings and root them in water and after that, put them back into, you know, potted dirt and just multiply that way. I'm doing this, and they're taking to water very well. They're sprouting really nice roots, but every time I take it from the water and go into a pot of dirt, they decline very fast.
I actually have a couple of houseplants that family members have given me from Virginia that I've not known how to care for, but they gave them to me in these really ornate water-filled vases, and the roots look good. So I'll tell you, I have grown some of these, including succulents, simply in these water-filled vases and never tried to transplant them. Because I know that once those roots get any kind of size, they're never going to be transplantable into soil. And that's all right. I mean, you've already shown you can grow hydroponically, Josh, and you know, after climate change puts down its next boot into us, maybe that's going to be the way to go, especially in Oklahoma. But here's the deal. When plants grow in water for a long period of time, they get these long, elegant roots. Now, those roots, again, this plant might survive in water for many years, maybe even decades, as long as you're changing the water. But those roots in their life have never met the resistance that you get even from the lightest potting soils. So as soon as they're put into soil, it really is. It's like taking a fish out of a river and putting it in your front yard and expecting it to go fetch. It's just not going to be a good day for the yard or the fish. So,
I see.
But it's been fun, and it's been pretty to look at, and you haven't killed anything yet. In terms of the gardening world with children, you're hitting like 400. Don't worry about it. Now, if you really want to propagate these plants, you said you had pathos?
Yes.
Okay. And it really almost doesn't matter. But the best time to take cuttings is in the spring, because even indoors, you notice that these plants have somewhat of a cycle, but that's the growth that is the most vigorous. So you want to go in between now and then, you want to go out to a good garden center and get a high quality bag of soil free mix. Now, it won't say that on the bag. It may say something like Pro Mix, seed starting soil. Some bags that are labeled potting soil are okay if the bag feels unnaturally light. You want a mixture of typically peat, perlite, vermiculite, and a little bit of compost for texture. So then you take some regular pots like you have your houseplants in, plastic pots with good drainage. You fill them with the light potting soil mix. And then before you do anything else, you take these pots filled with this dry soil to a sink, and you may need bricks or something heavy because you're going to fill the sink with a couple inches of water. Then you're going to put the pots in, but because the soil has never been saturated, they're going to float around. So put something heavy on top, and an hour later, you'll be amazed. The soil will be totally saturated. It'll be five times as heavy, and then you take it out. You let it drain on like your drain board, something like that. Put it on a saucer. And then using a pair of sharp scissors, you take a couple of cuttings, and then you get a pencil. And instead of jamming the cutting into the soil-free mix, you use a pencil to make a little hole in the mix. Then you drop the end of the cutting down into it. Then you push the soil back with your fingers and put it in a place where it gets ambient light so far, not bright light. You don't want to burn this thing. And keep that soil constantly moist. The best thing you could do would be to get a little spritzer from the dollar store or something and just mist it every morning with some water. But don't expose it to a lot of heat or bright light. And then be patient. Don't let that soil-free mix dry out. And after a couple of weeks, you will notice it getting larger. You will notice it starting to grow. That means underneath, inside the soil, it's now developed its own roots. You can start cutting back on the water and treating it like a regular house plant. And you can fill your house with these things as long as you know those couple of little tricks.
Okay. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Josh. Good luck, sir.
All right. Thanks.
1-888-346-9499. Andrea, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being had, Andrea. Where are you?
I'm in Cornwall, Vermont.
Oh, that sounds absolutely lovely.
It is. The beautiful Lake Champlain Valley.
What's going on up in Lake Champlain?
Well, I'm hoping you can help my husband and I with our buckthorn battle.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm double parked outside. I have to go. Thanks.
Oh, well, I hope not. I hope you can really help us. Having a big problem here. We have 75 acres of land that we bought about 5 years ago. And we're really just hoping to clear it up around some of the nice trees that we have. We have a lot of nice big old shagbark hickories and some maples.
Oh, they're great.
And the buckthorn just seems to attack the whole bottom of the tree and get tangled up in them.
Mm-hmm.
And they just don't look very nice.
Right. Okay, so full disclosure, you called last week. And I saw your call up on the screen, and I looked at what you wanted to talk about, and I pointed at my producer and said, no, I can't do it. I don't know anything. And she felt bad, and I felt bad, so we arranged for you to come back. And in the meantime, I did some research, and there are a surprising amount of resources available to you. Now, this is a very invasive tree. As you know, it produces berries in the fall. And those berries contain seeds that can stay active in the soil for 5 years.
Yes.
In addition, the tree is what's called a re-sprouter, like black locust. If you cut it down to a stump, it will continue to regrow from that stump. But it does not send up suckers. It's only the stump. So
Okay. People
who use chemicals try to attack this tree by cutting it down and then painting it with herbicides or soaking the ground with systemic herbicides. And I was so pleased when I did some basic research to see that most web pages, from university sources included, were very much against the use of herbicides and were offering a lot of different options.
Oh, wonderful.
So where I want you to go, not physically, but on the internet, are Wisconsin and Minnesota. And I apologize because my dyslexia has kicked in. And one is the university, which I think is Minnesota, and the other is their Department of Natural Resources.
Okay.
But if you click buckthorn control, they both pop up at the top. And there are a vast array of tools that have come on the market in the last 10 years for people to use to control invasive plants mechanically. Then there were highly detailed seasonal instructions about when not to do this, because if you do it at a certain time of year, you kind of trigger the germination of all those seeds in your soil.
Right.
But you also want to do the cutting before they can set seed. Now, the cool thing is there is both a technique and a licensed product called the Buckthorn Baggie. The buckthorn baggie I first encountered as like a thing that an extension agent was talking about. His version was to get heavy black plastic, and after you would cut the buckthorn tree down to a stump, you would cover it with the black plastic using a certain technique, and that would prevent the re-sprouting. The other thing they recommended was literally cutting it down to a certain size and nailing a coffee can over the top, and, you know, pounding nails in the side
right, to
prevent re-sprouting. So I thought that was really cool, and then I found this link, and it turns out that there is a licensed product, a patented product called the Buckthorn Baggie, and this is exactly the right thickness of plastic, and it has like a clamp at the bottom. So you put it on, and you tighten this clamp, and it really stays on the stump. They warn, go slowly, do small areas at a time,
right. Work
on the outskirts. You're never going to get it out of the deep woods.
Yeah.
But every year that you want to devote a little more time, energy, and baggy money, you can push further back and you can get this under control. And then once you get the area around your house under control, you can simply concentrate on preventing seed formation, which is a lot easier.
Well, thank you so much for this help. I appreciate it very much.
It's my pleasure. I apologize for last week's cowardice, but it turned into a better call this week.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much.
All right, good luck, Andrea.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Heather, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for being had, Heather. Where are you?
I'm at Lake Langenoor, Maryland. It's just outside of Frederick and an hour from Baltimore and D.C. both.
Oh, okay. I'd never heard of that. Is it a small community?
It is. It's a man-made 200-acre lake. It's about 20 minutes from downtown Frederick.
And do you live on the water?
No. We just purchased a home here a couple months ago. We weren't lucky enough to get one right on the water, but I can walk to a sandy beach, and I'm really happy about
that. Oh, that's the bee's knees. That's perfect. All right, so what can we do for Heather, who now lives near a lake?
So I've got this big backyard that's flat, and I want to landscape it to have a lot of color and to attract pollinators and hummingbirds and support the wildlife. I also like to grow herbs to use in cooking, and maybe I'd even try some vegetables. But I saw some of those yellow flags in my yard warning pesticide application, which shows me that the former owners probably, you know, applied pesticides. So I'm wondering how safe it is to grow stuff I'm going to eat and how I could find out.
Well, that's interesting. The flags were still there when you purchased the property a couple months ago?
I just found a couple floating around, like one was stuck under the deck and one was behind some bushes.
Well, okay, so here's the deal. First of all, for your herbs and vegetable gardens, I don't want you to grow directly in your soil. That's a chump game.
Okay.
What I want you to do is frame out some nice raised beds that are no wider than 4 feet. They can be as long as you want, with 2-foot walking lanes in between. And the reason they're no wider than 4 feet is you're not going to step in them. You're going to fill them with a beautiful mixture of purchased compost and topsoil. And then the benefits, it's raised off the ground. So in a flat area, you're protected during floods. It won't get up to the level of the plants. You won't have to worry about any residual long-lasting chemicals in your soil. And your productivity, you can literally grow 4 times as much in a raised bed as you can on flat earth. And weed control is a lot easier.
Great.
Yeah, so that's the smart money when you want to have a kitchen garden, have a food garden. As to your landscaping for wildlife, I will tell you that if you wanted to be an organic farmer, and you purchased this land and you didn't know anything about it, or you did know that it had been farmed conventionally, it would be 3 years before you could be certified organic. But even during that 3-year period, you would be called what's in transition. You know, generally everything washes out except the most persistent herbicides and pesticides during the first year period. And then after that, really the only thing you have to worry about is what you're using. And oddly enough, the plants you're buying, some of the native plants, some butterfly plants, unfortunately, have been treated with systemic pesticides, the notorious neonics. And this protects them from insect attack, but it also makes them deadly to bees and butterflies and other pollinators. So in that case, I would worry less about your soil than about the quality of the plant material. You want to make sure as you do your landscaping, as you select the plants that you're going to put in, especially for the purposes you've described, that you stay mostly native plants. You don't have to be 100% native plant, but that's going to be the best, especially for the kind of region you're in with the lake there. And make sure they were grown without the use of these neonics.
Okay, so I just have to look for that. Do you have any suggestions about good plants that are not likely to be eaten by the rabbits and deer, which hang out all around here and in my yard?
Rabbits will almost eat anything. Deer will generally eat anything when it's young, which means the plants, whether it's rabbits or deer, should be, when they're young, they should be protected by simple wire cages. Or if you want, you can spray them with repellent frequently, but the wire cages are a much less expensive option. Then once a plant gets to size, remember that, you know, rabbits can only reach what they can reach, which does make plants vulnerable during deep snow. The rabbits can then get at the top of the plant, the most tender part. If you go to our website, go to youbetyourgarden.org and go to Garden Answers A to Z and click on deer, you will be taken to articles that then take you through to, we must have four lists of deer resistant plants, plants that deer eat least. And something that I found even more impressive is list of plants that are graded like A to Z. You know, A, the deer will eat them before they're out of your car, down to down to like deer or F, that the deer are now eating your siding before they'll come and eat this plant.
Okay, that's great.
But that is the wise way if you don't want to invest in a giant fence, is to landscape with deer-resistant plants. But remember, they have to be protected while they're young. Even these big thorny plants and these tough plants are tender enough for deer to eat when they're still small.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. And next time you're around Frederick, you'll have to get my number from your staff and give me a call so you could come to the beach or explore the 35 miles of trails we have here at Lake Linganore.
Okay. I love the water. All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Take care. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will appear at the Master Gardeners Spring Symposium in Fayetteville, North Carolina on March 25th and in beautiful State College, PA, April 6th through the 8th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with the truth about greenhouses and cold frames and more of your truthful phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 140th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, fighting off a cold, Mike McGrath. In just a little bit now, we'll get to the question of the week, which is also about colds of a different type. The kind of cold that wants to kill your young tomato plants. We'll talk about whether a greenhouse is the way to prevent that premature death of your tomatoes. In the meantime, however, a couple more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Bill, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how are you?
I am dying, Bill. You know, all these bugs been flying around. I think six of them just bit me, but I'm hanging in there. How are you, man?
Real good.
And where is Bill real good?
I'm from Westchester, Pennsylvania.
Okay, very good. Just outside of Philadelphia. What can we do for Bill in Westchester?
Well, I'm pretty fanatical about growing tomatoes, but I have a raised bed garden that is just a certain size.
Right.
And I really don't have the ability to move the tomatoes around like you have advised, too far, maybe 2 feet apiece. And I wondered whether there was anything you could do in the wintertime to replenish whatever the tomatoes take out of the soil.
Oh, that's not what's going on, Bill. Tomatoes are not heavy feeders. Be talking about sweet corn or something like that that would suck a lot of nutrients out of the soil. What happens is there's a symbiotic relationship between the roots of tomatoes, very specifically, some other plants, but with tomatoes it's the most pronounced, and soil-borne organisms that are under the general category of wilts. In our area here in Pennsylvania, it's mostly verticillium wilt. That's the one that flourishes in areas with cold winters. So the first year you plant a tomato in a certain like square of soil, the organism finds the roots of the tomatoes, they say hi, and that's the end of it. The second year, the organism begins to flourish more if tomato roots are planted in the same spot. By the third year, this wilt has really colonized the soil. There's a lot of it. And if the roots of a tomato go into that patch of soil, that wilt will cause the bottom leaves of the tomatoes to turn yellow, and then the yellowing will progress up the plant. But by year four, if you plant in that same spot again, that yellowing starts right away and proceeds very quickly. So by year four or five, your plants are dying. Some people report success with literally shoveling out most of the soil and replacing it.
Oof. That's I know. A lot of work.
Yeah. Not what you were thinking of. So how much space do you have?
It's about 10 by 18.
18 feet or 18 inches?
Feet.
Okay. So it's not a raised bed or anything like that?
It is a raised bed, yeah, actually, yes.
But
yeah.
But you have to step in it.
You have to step up to it, yeah. It comes off the back of a shed and the slope goes downhill, so on the low side, you're literally over 2 feet in the air.
What I'm saying is a raised bed should never be wider than 4 feet, because you're making any problems worse by compressing the soil and walking around your plants. As you proceed in your gardening life, it might be good to actually section off that area into a series of raised beds no wider than 4 feet, and that way you'll be able to monitor where your tomato plants are growing more carefully.
Okay.
So you said you can only move your plants over by like 2 feet. Well, 2 feet is kind of the magic number. That's basically the footprint of a tomato vine's roots. I use big cages to grow my tomatoes inside of, and they're about 2 feet in diameter. And at the end of the season, when you pull up the dead plants, you realize that the roots didn't really travel that far. If you plant just to the side of that, and, you know, maybe a tenth of your root system is getting exposed to the soil-borne disease, it's not going to be a big problem. But the thing is, from now on, now that you recognize this is an issue, and I presume you're experiencing problems with verticillium.
Yes.
Yeah, from now on, your biggest task is to keep good records or make a physical thing to show you where tomato plants were grown the previous year, like a circle of popsicle sticks, a distinctive rock or a brick over top of the center of where it was, and do your best to move things around. But for the future, I really urge you to go to our website, click on the button at the top that says Garden Answers A to Z, go to R for Raised Beds, and read about the way to make raised beds and the benefits. If you do not step on the garden soil, especially around tomato plants, which are very susceptible to being in compressed soil, it's not good for them, that may help keep them healthy as well. You'd be surprised at the benefits of not stepping in your growing soil.
Okay.
Good luck, sir.
All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
1-888-346-9499. Ralph, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, how are you today, Mike?
I'm just ducky today. Ralph, how are you, sir?
Very good, thank you.
And where is Ralph very good?
I'm in Warren County, New Jersey. It's northwestern part of New Jersey, up by the Delaware Water Gap.
Oh, okay. That's a nice area up there.
Yeah, beautiful.
All right. What can we do for Ralph in the Garden State?
I had purchased up in Cortland, New York in 1999, two apple trees. They were Cortland apples. They were about a quarter inch in diameter. One had one apple on it. The other one had two apples on it. And they're in 5-gallon buckets. I brought them home. I planted them in the front yard. And they've never produced any fruit since the time I brought them home. Now, I know those two apples weren't glued to the tree. They were. It was a real apple tree.
So
they're probably 4-inch in diameter right now, and I do prune them. I don't know if I'm pruning them correctly or not, but I get about 5 blooms a year in each one, and that's it.
Okay, that's really weird. Are they getting good sun?
Yes, they get plenty of sun.
Are they growing in or near a lawn?
There's a retention basin, and I'm planted in with probably about 30 trees altogether, but these two are the oldest ones, and the ones that produced the least of the blooms, I should say.
Right.
But there is lawn there, yes.
Okay. And do you feed the lawn?
No, I don't.
Okay. So you haven't fed these plants anything?
No.
Now, you say they're in a retention basin. Is this an area that collects and holds water and then allows it to drain?
They're at the top of the basin. So part of my concern was whether when they dug the basin out and that dirt formed a rim, an area beyond the rim, where they lost the dirt. I'm wondering if maybe the soil is just so poor that it doesn't allow the tree to produce.
That's possible, and you haven't fed them anything.
I haven't, no.
Okay. Well, you know, the blooms, whatever blooms exist on your tree, have existed there since the fall. So, you know, this year you got what you got already. Now, you say you prune them every year. When do you prune them?
Actually, I just pruned them about 3 or 4 weeks ago.
And what did you do?
The water shoots that come straight up. I lopped them off close to the branch as possible. And any intersecting branches that may interfere with another one, I try to cut them clear of each other.
Okay.
And it looks like the typical tree you see in an orchard, you know, all hanging over.
So I want you to go out to a garden center, and I want you to get a bag of rock phosphate. It is a natural mined material that is high in phosphorus. Phosphorus is the fruiting nutrient. Do you make compost? Do you have compost available to you nearby? Does your municipality make it? Does somebody sell it?
I'm sure I could pick it up at a garden center, some compost, certainly.
So what I want you to do is a little bit of rock phosphate goes a long way. The size of your trees, 1/2 cup to 1 cup each. Just spread lightly, starting like 6 inches away from the tree itself, going out over top of what we perceive to be the root system, and then cover that with 2 inches of compost. Don't let the compost cover the trunk of the tree, but start a few inches out and then go out as far as you have enough compost to cover. The rock phosphate will provide perhaps the missing nutrient in this picture, but the compost will do an all-over job of soil improvement and putting some nutrients in the soil. Apple trees and peach trees also just especially love a mulch of compost. And then if you still get few flowers this year, just don't worry about it. Although you say you haven't gotten any fruit, so if you do get a small number of flowers and you want to have sex with your trees, go out there with a little paintbrush, and when the flowers are fully open, use the paintbrush to move some of the pollen from tree to tree.
Oh, okay.
And you might be able to induce fruiting. Rock phosphate takes a long time to be available in the soil, but your trees are going to set their fruit in the late spring, early summer, you know, through the fall. So yeah. By the time they're setting the following year's crop, that rock phosphate should be very available in the soil. I would do the compost twice a year, every year. And if everything else is as you describe, I suspect the trees should be full of flowers next season.
Well, okay. That sounds great. Give it a shot.
All right. Good luck, sir.
All right. Thank you very much, Mike.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right, it is time for the question of the week. What can an inexpensive greenhouse be expected to do for you. Expensive Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden. Please get us started with this week's question.
Thanks, Mike. Sally in Richmond, Virginia writes, I find your podcast to be interesting and helpful. I recently read your article at the Gardens Alive website about greenhouses and was wondering if you had any recommendations for a specific greenhouse I could buy in the $200 price range. I realize this is a super tight budget, but it's all I can afford, especially considering that I'll still have to buy a lot of other supplies. Mike, I'm guessing there's no way you can pointer to a perfect two-bill greenhouse.
Especially when we have no idea what she expects to get out of it. So I emailed her back to ask what she intends to use it for. Her response was,
I am looking to be able to start my seeds outside.
Okay, now this question in general is great timing, as seed starting for plants like tomatoes can begin as early as March 1st in the Richmond area, more like March 15th in my northeastern Pennsylvania garden. And there's honestly no better place to germinate seeds and grow out young plants than in a greenhouse.
I gotta say, I'm shocked. I was certain you were going to say that she should just put that money towards a nice indoor seed starting setup with good lights. Mike, you're not saying anything.
Because that is what I'm eventually going to say. Are you the type of person who tells somebody who's about to see Psycho for the first time that the killer is really Norman Bates and not his mother?
Yes.
Anyway, a true greenhouse is amazing. By the time we get to March, the hours of daylight are much longer, and the sun is getting to the right angle for good photosynthesis. And the open to the sun all around structure of a greenhouse allows plants to get as much, maybe even more natural light than they will when they're planted out in the garden.
But?
Citing the Dave's Garden website, which is often an excellent resource, her quote, last average frost date in Richmond is April 15th, essentially a month before mine. But they explain further, using language that I absolutely love, that this means, quote, almost certainly you will receive frost through the 2nd of April and are almost guaranteed that you will not see frost after the 28th of April. That really puts things in perspective.
So plants started at the beginning of March in an unheated greenhouse are almost guaranteed to be exposed to below freezing nights. And, as you often explain, also a lot of just plain too cold for tropical plant nights.
Exactly. Research shows that exposing young tropical plants like tomatoes and peppers to temps even in the low 40s can set them back really hard and delay the harvest by weeks. So an unheated greenhouse is going to supply the necessary light, but it's going to lose any of its daytime warmth shortly after the sun goes down. I know this for a fact. I had a greenhouse back when I was a major exhibitor in the Philadelphia Flower Show. It was well insulated. The growing bench inside was completely covered with heating mats. We had one of those oil-filled radiators that we rolled inside. And the high-intensity lights that we used gave off an enormous amount of heat. And they were timed to go on at 10 o'clock at night and stay on until sunrise. And we had a small fan mounted at the top of the ceiling to force that warm air back down towards the plants.
So we're talking like $200 a month just in electricity.
Right. And you get one prolonged power failure and everything you've invested up to then is just shot dead.
So?
So something like a greenhouse that sits flush to a heated structure like your house, into which you can run a portable heater on a timer on freezing cold nights, could work well most seasons, especially if the, quote, glazing material involved is solid, like glass or heavy plastic panels. But a standalone structure would require much too much supplemental heat. And a late snow could damage or collapse anything made out of stretch plastic. Heck, my farmer friends have seen industrial-grade hoop houses severely damaged by high winds and ice storms.
Okay, so take that money and buy a nice indoor seed starting system with stackable trays and multiple lights and use the free heat of your home.
And then if you want, after the starts reach a decent size, say at about 4 weeks of age, when the nighttime temps won't be as dangerous, then you can think about moving them out to a little greenhouse-like structure for their hardening off period, or to cold frames built against the side of your house and angled south. One of the best gardeners I know starts his plants under lights in his basement and then grows them out in cold frames towards the end. But you also have to be aware that a closed structure under glass or plastic is going to build heat up dramatically on a sunny day. So now you either need automatic venting systems or the ability and inclination to prop cold frames open or vent the greenhouse on sunny days and then be sure to seal them up tight again that night.
So forget it then?
No, absolutely not. Experienced gardeners can handle these kind of systems well. But it takes the right personality. One unvented day or one uncovered night, and you're buying your tomatoes at the garden center that year. Well, that sure was some interesting information about the ups and downs of greenhouse growing now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, or to buy new plants to replace the ones you just killed, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to paint my greenhouse black if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find the answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work and like us at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Larissa Sapko and Rich Banowitz keep our website painted black. Enlightened Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY FM in Philadelphia. Our editor, Al Banks, secretly wishes he was Venus Flytrap from the show WKRP in Cincinnati. Our intern, Michael Inglaze, does not get any of these references, and he's still wearing a tie. I'm old and in the way, Mike McGrath, and I'll pull off my tie, remove my glasses, cast off my fedora, look in both directions, dive into the stockroom, open the convenient giant-sized windows, and see you again next week. Getting hit by a hard frost when your fruits are in flower can ruin an entire season. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll explain how to choose the safest plants and what to do when your best plans go awry. Plus your rye phone calls.